Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series. In an event co-sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council, we'll hear a presentation entitled John A. Creighton, Blazing the First Internet, with Brian Kokensparger, Computer Support Coordinator for the Creighton College of Arts and Sciences at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 15, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, the Nebraska Humanities Council, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
In support of our Crossroads of Commerce exhibit, our guest this evening is Count John A. Creighton, a count of the Papal Court born near Glenford, Ohio in 1831. With his brother Edward, John helped build a transcontinental telegraph, in addition to contributing to a multitude of business ventures. Together, they helped Omaha grow from a muddy backwater town into the gateway to the West. He is here today to tell us about the telegraph and to answer any questions you might have about the Creighton family. Ladies and gentlemen, John A. Creighton.
Well done, my good man, well done. Now, I must admit, I'm inclined not to speak in front of great big groups. To tell you the truth, the last few times I've tried to do that, I've been petrified and had no speech, no words to come out. So if you find me stuttering and perhaps not flourishing in my speech, then you understand why. My brother Edward, God rest his soul, he was the public speaker. He was the one that would stand up in front of groups and sell whatever it is that he happened to be involved with. And believe me, he was involved with many things. So I want to thank you for inviting me here to speak with you in the old railroad depot. Though, I must admit, I don't remember the railroad depot being quite this grand, but Nevertheless, be it far from a Creighton to stand in the way of progress. And speaking of progress, I just heard yesterday that they are starting to build houses way out beyond 40th Street. I don't know if you've heard the same thing, but it boggles the mind, this progress in this building. What I'd like you to do, though, is think a little bit about the transcontinental telegraph. That's the one big venture that I had and that I became involved with that I feel has really put the Creightons and put Omaha rightly where Omaha needs to be. So I want you to think back to 1790. That's the last century, of course, 1790, not this century. And think that you want to send a message, let's say, your poor, dear brother has passed on, perhaps not unexpectedly, but passed on all the same, and you need to send a message to your cousin who is 30 miles away. What do you do? Well, there's a couple things that you could do. If you're an old Greek, you could give the message to a runner and have the runner run the message 30 miles down the road, as they did with the well-documented Battle of Marathon. You can do that, or you can give it to a horse and rider and let the rider take the horse for a good day and a half at least, to the point, give the message, the cousin replies and carries it back. All things considered, we're talking about perhaps 3 or 4 days to get a message 30 miles. Well, there were a couple of brothers in France, the Chappé brothers, René and Claude. They thought that that was not acceptable. So they decided that they would work on how to get messages faster. So they developed the tachygraph, the fast writer. And so what they did was they had a timepiece, which is your typical timepiece with the second hand that goes around. They took off the hours, they took off the minutes, and they put a new face onto the timepiece. And this face only had 10 numbers. They made one, then they made another, exactly the same. And then they wrote up a code book. This number meant this letter. This number meant that letter. And then once they gave the code book, they both had a copy of that. They wrote it down. They synchronized both of their timepieces so that they were exactly at the same time. And one brother picked up his timepiece and his code book and walked to the other side of the field. The other brother stayed where he was. Now, the first brother had a pot and a metal spoon. And when he decided what message he'd want to send, he waited for the number to get to the right place for the letter that he wanted to send, and he would clang the pan hard. The other brother, hearing the clang of the pan, would write down the letter that corresponded to the clang of the pan. Now, of course, 10 numbers, they had about 20 letters. So, of course, they had to clang twice. And so they worked out their code in this manner. So they were able to pass the message back and forth by the clanging of the pans. And this they thought was good. It was a good improvement over giving the message to a horse and rider and sending the horse and rider off. But there was a problem with this. There were a couple of problems with this. You might be far enough away that you can't hear the clang of a pan. So you were limited in the amount of distance that you could cover with that. I must say the Creightons have thrown a few rollicking parties in their day, and the neighbors didn't appreciate that either. But certainly, the clanging of the pan in the middle of the night might make the neighbors a little bit angry. So, yes, there were certainly a couple of problems with this first telegraph or this tachygraph. But the Chappé brothers, they worked hard. They developed another idea, and that was instead of having a pan to bang, instead, they held up a big panel. One side of the panel was black. The other side of the panel was white. They'd hold that up. They'd have the same clock. And instead of banging a pan, they would turn the panel according to the time. That was good. They were able to go a farther distance because they could even look at the panel with a spyglass. And certainly in the middle of the night, they made no noise. However, there were a couple of problems with this. Can't see at night, indeed. Of course, the French were able to develop a system where they used torches from then on, and with torches you can see. However, has anyone been in France? Especially in the spring and the fall, what happens in France? Fog. If you have fog, you can't see a thing. You can't see within 10 feet. So The Chappé brothers continued in this manner, and they developed the tachygraph, which was the first telegraph, by the way. And the French army and Napoleon actually used this tachygraph, to relay messages back and forth. And in fact, Napoleon wanted to continue it into England, only he fell a little short of that mark. So then, after that, an amazing, miraculous thing was discovered, the electric spark. This was to revolutionize sending messages. And independently, there were a couple of fellows over in England, Whetstone and Cook, who were working on this idea of using the electric spark to send messages. Over here in these United States, Samuel F.B. Morse was also working on the idea. Now let's look at Whetstone first. He used a great invention called the galvanometer. And what the galvanometer does is when you pass the electric spark through a wire, it makes a needle move to the opposite direction. You take the spark away from the wire, and the needle moves back. He saw the utility in that. So he set up a little diamond-shaped apparatus with 5 wires coming into it, 5 galvanometers, and by that way managed at one time to send one letter each time up to 20 different letters. So that was happening in good old England. In these United States, Samuel F.B. Morse noted that a coil of wire that is coiled around a nail, when the spark is applied to it, would become a powerful magnet and would attract a piece of metal towards that powerful magnet. So he decided to attach a lead pencil to that magnet, so that as the magnet was attracted, the pencil would go down and write a letter on write a little note or a line on a sheet of paper, and as the spark was released, the pencil would go up and it would write the line at a higher rate. So by that way, he could do short sparks or large sparks, and we had a code book that would decipher that code as well. And he sent the very first message in a little lab that he set up over in Washington, D.C., I believe. And do you know what his first message was? What has God wrought? Exactly. Numbers 23:23. You can look it up when you go home, when you open up the good book. So all of this began to spring up here in these United States, and Samuel F.B. Morse decided to give an experiment to Congress so that Congress would begin to give money, to legislate and to give money in order to help with the development of the laying of the wires. And this experiment proved very well. There was a Democratic convention in town, and he tapped out the winner by vote of the convention, and some 10 miles away, the telegraph operator looked at the strip of paper, deciphered that, and then the whole lot jumped on the train, took the train up, and got off, and then found out, with nobody talking to them or anything, found out who the winner was. So thus, there was a proof that this device could actually send messages and could be effective as a way to fast write or far write the messages that did not require the horse and the rider. So let me talk a little bit. We don't want to put the cart in front of the mule. This new thing, this telegraph, most people don't know what was part of that. So there were basically four different parts. There was the key, and actually the reason it was the key was because there was actually a key in one of the original workups that Samuel F.B. Morse put together. And when the key is applied to a piece of metal, then the electrical spark is able to go around in a circle, and we call that a circuit. So when the key is applied, then the spark runs through the electromagnet, bringing the piece of metal down, and thus closing the circuit and deflecting the pen. After that, you need a voltaic pile. And a voltaic pile is lead bars and a lot of chemicals, and that provides the spark. That's where the spark is drawn out of. And then the final part is, of course, the wire. You cannot have a telegraph without having the wire. So you have four big parts. Now, when this telegraph was first started up, people didn't like it. They thought it was the work of the devil. And most people found that they had no use for it and didn't want it around. They would break into the stations. They would tear up the equipment. They would do all of those kinds of things that unhappy people do. But so some operators found themselves sitting around perhaps playing checkers with the other operators or telling jokes over the line. So it really wasn't used quite for the purposes that most people thought it should be used for. Another thing to keep in mind, though, is at this time, the age of spiritualism came forth. Now, think about it a little bit. With the spiritualists, there were seances. They sat around. They hoped to get messages from afar. They heard rappings. Things moved seemingly on their own. Think of all of those things. Then think about the telegraph. What is the telegraph but a sounder moving seemingly on its own, making noises, getting messages from some far-off place. So it's natural that some folks thought that maybe this was the work of the devil. But as we all know, that good commerce is done over the telegraph. So when we think about the telegraph and we think about all of its parts, what do you think is the most important part? The wire. Yes. My brother Edward, God rest his soul, was fascinated by the wire. You see, when he was working on our small farm near Springfield in Ohio, he was able to see a couple of Irish gents putting up the wire. And of course, Edward, being the curious gent that he was, stopped over to ask them. He was always really, really good with the gift of gab, of course. And he asked them what they were doing, and they told him. Well, before long, he knew who the superintendent of that line was. And before long, he had secured, after contacting the superintendent of the line, his first order of poles. Edward was like that. He would look for opportunities. And in cases like gold, he wouldn't go looking for the gold because he knew that there wasn't much future in that. He knew that all those people looking for gold needed shovels and needed picks and needed flour and corn and bacon. So he would supply that, and that's how he put together his fortunes. However, he was fascinated by the wire, and not about what it could do, but where it could go. So he put together and became the superintendent of the line from Dayton to Cincinnati in Ohio, and from Toledo to Cleveland. And he also helped to build the line from St. Joe's to Brownville. That was the first time when the line came in to this Nebraska territory. He also helped to extend the line then into Omaha. So he was fascinated by the wire. He moved in to Omaha back in 56, just a few years ago, and I followed him shortly thereafter. I have to admit to you, despite the wishes of my dear mother, I dropped out of school. And I joined her, and I joined Edward in this little town of Omaha. So he moved in, and Congress had laid a subsidy for the first company that could build the telegraph from the east to the west, and from Julesburg to Sacramento. So he wanted that subsidy. So in November back in 60, dear Edward got on his mule, and he rode through a November snowstorm and all that entailed to try to survey the line from Julesburg into Salt Lake City. He was able to do it. It took him a few weeks, but he was able to do it. So then, in March of that next year, he needed to survey the rest of the line. So he started in Salt Lake, and he made his way through Carson City, Nevada. Now, I don't know if any of you have been over that rugged territory. I've been over it a few times, but the mountains, the thick snow, the wind, the beasts, all of these things contributed to making his journey a perilous one. He arrived in Carson City more alive than dead, skin peeling from his face, snow blind. And you know what it was that he said when he got there? It can be done. And the Creightons are the ones to do it. You see, Edward, God rest his soul, from the time I was a wee lad, he always was setting about finding opportunities for us. And you might say that I walked in his shadow. But his shadow is a mighty fine place to be in during the hot heat of the summer in the high plains when you're putting up telegraph poles. As it was, I was the superintendent of the part of the line from Fort Laramie to Fort Bridger. My brother Edward was superintendent of the entire eastern section of the line. We were working towards Fort Bridger, and there was a race. We had the part of the line from Julesburg to Salt Lake City, and Mr. Gamble and his crew had the part of the line from Sacramento to Salt Lake City, and there was a race. Who would win? Of course, who do you think won? But we won't get there until a little bit. So there was a race on, and the winner, the one who reached Salt Lake first, could enjoy the wages of the other crew for the entire remainder of the time that it took the other crew to reach. So there were bragging rights at stake as well as real money. And if any of you know Irishmen, you know bragging rights are probably more important than the real money. So the race was on. I was doing my part. We were less than 2 miles from Fort Bridger when disaster struck. We ran out of wire. Plumb ran out. I had messed up in my calculations. I didn't know what to do. What can you do? You're 2 miles and less than from Fort Bridger. The only thing I could do was send a telegraph message back asking for more wire to be sent by mail. But I knew that it would be days, if perhaps not a week or more, before that wire would be sent off. However, we were in a private reserve, a federal reserve. There were plenty of black-tailed deer and sheep to eat. So the crew didn't think it was too bad. So we settled in and figured that we'd have a long wait. Well, the next morning, out of the west, a cloud arose. And out of this cloud appeared a stagecoach. And on top of this stagecoach was a gentleman waving a white handkerchief as fast as he could wave it. Well, it was Edward, God rest his soul. Now I had to figure out what to tell him. So he got in and alighted from the stagecoach. And I said, Dear Edward, I have something to tell you. And of course, Edward said, why is your crew not working? Are you as lazy as Joseph? Joseph was one of the other brothers who was unfortunately kicked off of one of the wagon teams because he didn't want to work. But he certainly likes spending the Creighton money, that's for sure. And I said, no, we ran out of wire, Edward, and I don't know what to do. So Edward looked at me a little bit and said, oh, Johnny, you will not need wire. We have wire enough. And I looked around and looked in his pocket, and I said, Eddie, we're out of wire. We have no wire. We have 2 miles. And he opened up the stagecoach door, and inside the stagecoach was enough wire to finish the job. You see, Edward, who was up on the other side of Fort Bridger, had gone over the calculations and had seen my mistake. So he had secured enough wire and brought it back. That very day, Edward himself spliced the wires together to complete the eastern section of the Transcontinental Telegraph. And Edward, of course, being a family man, sent the first message to his wife, October 17th, 1831. 1831 is my birthday. 1861, Mrs. Edward Creighton, Omaha, Nebraska. This being the first message over the new line since its completion to Salt Lake, allow me to greet you. In a few days, two oceans will be united. It was indeed just a few days. It was a week, and the Overland Telegraph Company finished their segment, and the Transcontinental Telegraph was complete. The first message was sent by dignitaries in California to President Abe Lincoln himself, informing Abe Lincoln of California's support in the upcoming war between the states. So two oceans were united with one wire. Of course, what's the good of a wire if people can't use it? So there were some problems and some things to think about after the wire had been put into place. The first thing that happened, of course, was we really didn't need the Pony Express anymore. We'd gotten kind of fond on the line of the Pony Express riders because even though they were pretty busy and had to pass us by many times, every now and then they'd stop for a drink of water and chat for just a second or two. And certainly after the Transcontinental Telegraph was created and finished, they had to finish out all the letters and things that they had taken, but almost overnight, that part, that segment of our history was closed down. But they also, many of the states then, had to start thinking about the problems that were caused by having a telegraph and some of the questions that arose. And one of the first questions was the idea of right-of-way. When these telegraph lines were set up, the whole way that it worked was that you had to have spokes like a wheel going from town to town. There had to be a wire from pretty much every town to every other town so that everyone could get involved. Because the whole idea was when you went down to send a message, when I went down, I would go down to the nearest station, I would scrawl out my message, and I would give it, and I would pay the fee, and the fee for, at least a few years ago when we started, for a 10-word message to Sacramento was about $7.50. So you didn't take it lightly. So you would write out, you'd pay your fee, and then the operator would take it and tap it out. Now, normally, if you were just sending it to someone on the line, then there'd be an operator on the line who by that time would listen and hear the message, write out the message, give it to the delivery boy who would take it off and deliver it. However, let's say I was sending the message to St. Louis, and the only line that was open was the line to Chicago. Then what would happen would be the operator would key it in. It would go down to the main station right here in Omaha. They would listen, write it down, put it on the new line, the transcontinental line, tap it out. Then in Chicago, they would put it into the line that would then go to St. Louis, where it would be copied down and it would be delivered. So sometimes a message could be put on the line, transcribed, listened to, and traded over a number of times. I've never had any problems, but I heard occasionally there would be a mistake or two made along the way with some very, very interesting results. So the state had to worry about right-of-way because we had to have several towns all part of this. And so usually the most common way was to send the line along cart roads, regular roads, perhaps railroads as the railroads were starting to be developed, and bridges. And sometimes these landowners would decide that they were going to block the telegraph from coming through their land and charge a huge fee. Well, this halted progress. So many states enacted legislation where landowners had to provide reasonable access for right-of-way to the telegraph as it was coming through. And within that was normally set up terms for reimbursement of some kind, such as stock in the telegraph company, or perhaps free or reduced services. So that's one of the big problems that they had to work with. Another one of the problems that they had to work with was unscrupulous bandits pushing down the wire. If you can imagine, bank robbers, if they were going to the next town, it would be easy to catch them by simply telegraphing a message to the next town telling the sheriff to stop them. So they wanted to push down the wires. However, there were very, very stiff penalties associated with harming the wires. Do you want to know how stiff? 6 months solitary confinement as a minimum, 2 years to life of hard labor in the state penitentiary for tearing down a wire. Those were the penalties in New Hampshire. Now, other states were a little more lenient, but certainly they wanted to enact legislation to make sure that these wires were protected. Once the wires were up, they had some other things to worry about. People started using these wires for commerce, to do business, to sell stocks, etc. And so one of the first things they also had to worry about was which messages they would accept. Because if you think about it, a newspaper could have an exclusive right with a telegraph company and allow only its reporters to report the news from that area. So one of the first things that they had to do was legislate that any message that was legal could be accepted and would be accepted. So that's one. Another one had to do with the order of the messages. You see, say that you have stock in a flower company, and say that that flower company burned to the ground in your town. Well, your stock's not going to be very good. So if you ran down to the station to put in a message, and you're there at the same time as the reporter who's reporting the message to the press, you could give the operator a little extra money to hold back that report for a while. You could send your message asking for your stock to be sold. Once it's sold, the message goes through, and you don't end up losing money, and someone else certainly does. So the general idea was that any message was received, and the order had to do with news and emergencies and government first, then business and pleasure after that. And finally, the last thing they had to think about is disclosure. A good telegraph operator could probably make quite a bit of money selling the information given to him or to her, because there were plenty of women, who are operating on it now. But the operator could make plenty of money selling the information to the highest bidder. So with all of these things, there were a lot of things to think about. Now, my brother Edward with the Transcontinental Telegraph, he had to protect the lines that he had built. And there were a lot of dangers to the lines out there in the prairie. Who can think of a few things that might push down a wire or two? Indians. Well, yes. Yes, and we had our share of run-ins with the Indians. And I have to say, we found some friendly Indians. We traded with the Indians. But there were a few Indians who would kill our telegraph operators, who would burn down the lines and such. And so it was pretty much a mixture when we had. But yes, the Indians were not happy about the telegraph line, the magic wire pushing through their territory. And so they tried to do what they could to disrupt it. What are some other things that might push down the wire? Buffalo, yes. The buffalo with these big, thick hides loved our poles. They would come over and they would rub their little backs, sides, and rumps against them. And guess what? Someone had the idea, and I won't name names, but someone had the idea that maybe it was a good idea to pound big spikes into the poles. And maybe that would keep the buffalo away. Guess what? They loved those poles especially, because those were the nice little nails and spikes that they could rub their little backs into, or big backs. So you get a 1,500-pound, 2,000-pound buffalo pushing against your pole. It wouldn't take very long at all to get that pushed over. There's one more, actually two more big reasons why the lines might. What's it? Prairie fire. Yes, and other elements. Prairie fires would rush through, burn everything in their sight. But also cyclones, avalanches. You have to remember, these went through the mountains. So avalanches, deep snows, wind storms, all of these things. Ice storms followed by the wind. All of these things would knock down our wires. And then, one last thing, the war between the states. We had to protect the line for the war between the states because, of course, depending upon which side of the Mason-Dixon line you were on, you were concerned about either making sure that the troops could communicate with one another or making sure that they couldn't. And actually, as time went on, the Illinois and Mississippi telegraph line was built from Chicago through Iowa as a second route so that if the lines were pushed down in Missouri, we could still get messages back and forth to Washington, D.C. and the like. So there were a lot of things to think about at that. So the lines spread out, they prospered, and the railroad, of course, followed soon after. And the railroad took a slightly different route. The telegraph route was through Julesburg, Fort Laramie, and through the South Pass to Fort Bridger, and then down into Salt Lake. And the railroad pretty much took some of the same route, but went through the North Pass. And we actually helped build the lines that went along with the Transcontinental Railroad. There were two dual lines that went along with it, and it helped to communicate back and forth with messages about supplies that were needed, how things were coming, but it also helped give us more lines for transcontinental messages to go back and forth. When you think about the telegraph, and you think about what it is and how important it was, when you used to have to send a message before the transcontinental telegraph, you would have to take off on a steamer and take the steamer down and perhaps walk across the Isthmus of Panama, where you'd pick up yet another steamer that you would take then to California, or you'd have to go clear down around south of the Americas and take that up, and that could take weeks, perhaps months, depending on weather. Or you could do the Pony Express, and that would still take many, many days, and many letters got lost, all of those kinds of things. So the transcontinental telegraph allowed us to get messages back and forth in a number of hours. Some say minutes, but I have never heard of that happening because of the retranscription and people having to resend the messages and the like. But it still allowed us to become one country. We had one wire connecting two oceans. And for the first time, we felt like one United States. Thank you very much. Now, John Creighton will be happy to answer any of your questions that you might have for him. Yes? If someone is sending a message, how do they know that? How did they know that they got the line? The telegraph operators were trained to listen and to jump in when the line was free. And by the time that they got to where they weren't doing the paper anymore and they were listening, they could tell by the rhythm and by the content of the message when the message had ended. And there were also special characters that they would put at the end of each message. And then it was generally a free-for-all. Whoever could get in there first would get in there. After a while, certainly, when the companies were all put together with the Western Union, then they were trained to give certain operators precedence depending upon their seniority and depending upon the status of the sender, things like that. However, in general, it was pretty much a free-for-all at that point. The government gave a little bit of subsidies for us, but most of the money that was earned was through stock and through the money that people would pay for the messages to go. So the companies did indeed own the telegraph lines. And those companies that weren't connected to Western Union would often enter into agreements with Western Union. And in fact, there's one case where my brother, unscrupulously a bit perhaps, but he was in Cincinnati, I believe, and there was a line from Cincinnati to New Orleans, and he wanted to talk the owner of the line into joining with Western Union and working out an agreement. The owner would have nothing of it. So what he did was he started sending bids for poles and for wire and for insulators down the line, the very line that was in competition. And he even sent a notice about the head of Western Union coming to Cincinnati to talk about the building of a new line. So that was the old lemon squeeze. And as soon as the owner of that line caught wind of it, of course, they settled into agreement with Western Union, and all was well after that. My brother Edward had promised our mother, our dear mother, that he would send me to school upon her death. Well, he paid for me to go to a nice little school in Ohio, and we actually had a second farm and lived near there. However, my dear mother died, and the call of the West was upon us, so I dropped out of school. And I think Edward always felt that somehow he hadn't lived up to that promise, so he thought it was too late for me, but he thought that he might send other Irish boys and later girls to school. So he talked often about the desire to create a college right in Omaha. Well, God bless him, he passed away in 74. He passed away before that dream could be realized. But since his wife, Mary Lucretia, had heard about it, she set in her will $100,000 for Creighton University to be built and chartered. And God bless her, she didn't last long enough for that to happen either. But I then became executor of the funds, and it was written in her will. So I made sure that the money went to create the Creighton University. And we opened the doors in 78. And, of course, we had to open up just mostly as a high school because there really weren't people in the area who were learned enough to do college work. So we had to enter as a high school, and then as those students got old enough and had learned enough to do college work, then we added the college curriculum. I decided once the Transcontinental Telegraph was built, Edward really loved the wire, so he kept building, and he kept building roadbeds, building telegraphs, lines, and all of that. I decided more to go into the mercantile industry and to ship wagon loads of flour into the gold fields in what is now Montana. And so I took 48 wagon loads up. My first attempt, though, didn't work out very well. The spring thaws were happening, and we just couldn't get over the swollen rivers. So instead, we turned our carts and went to Salt Lake City and sold them all to Brigham Young at a good profit. And Brigham Young was more than happy to take them. And we got to be good friends with Brigham Young over the years. My second big wagon load, though, I was able to get them up to the gold mines, and felt like it was there was a lot of opportunity there. So I opened up a general store there, and I sold flour. I sold beef, bacon, pickles, sold shovels and picks, and pretty much anything that that folks would want to do their prospecting. My brother Edward also got into a lot of stock with the cattle. He had herds all over the state and in the western states as well. First National Bank, he helped create that and was the first president of the First National Bank. And when I did get back to Omaha, I started thinking that the rough country and the prospectors pretty much went away from the gold fields because they pretty much found all the gold that was there. So I came back and I started a grocery here in Omaha and joined with my good friend Charles Brown to start that grocery store up. So the thing about us Creightons, we look for opportunities, and we try to find the best way to provide people with what they need for the price that they're willing to pay. And the West being what it is, with the prospecting and with people moving into the West and moving into Omaha, there were always plenty of opportunities that we could find. I entered St. Joseph College in Ohio, and I wanted to be a civil engineer. So, of course, you want to take mathematics. And that pretty much did me in, I have to say. What determined the price of the message that would be sent? Pretty much it was the law of supply and demand for the most part. It was all wide open territory, and as much as I hate to admit it, Western Union pretty much had a monopoly and could charge what it wanted. But at the same time, distance made a big difference, as well as the number of words. Early on, the messages were flowing because very few people used it. So there was all kinds of time. So the messages were flowing. But after a while, there got to be a telegraphic style, a very short number of words. The words weren't short because it was by the word, but the number of words were short. And in fact, there's a good poet, Emily Dickinson, who was known to have a telegraphic style in her poetry that would match what she had noted in the various telegraphs that she had had heard and read. So even a poet got into the act of writing poetry in a telegraphic style. So how are we doing on time, sir? Oh, okay. I'll tell you what. Let me go over here and grab my glasses. And I'll come out of character. My name is actually Brian Kokensparger, and I certainly appreciate you all coming here. I work as a staff member in the dean's office at Creighton University at the College of Arts and Sciences. In fact, I see now that I have my glasses on, I see some of my coworkers here. Thank you for coming. And I also teach in the computer science department at Creighton University. And, of course, your question about Creighton, I usually don't bring it up until someone else does because I don't want to feel like I'm, you know, trying to, you know, plug the university or whatever over any others. So thank you for bringing that up. I'll give you your $5 later. Okay. But I do, I just want to tell you a little bit about why I got engrossed with the Creightons. Well, first of all, I came to Creighton. The first time I ever set foot on Creighton, I was in the admin building, which is now Creighton Hall, and I noticed some big boards in the base in the first floor, and they talked about the Creightons coming from Perry County, Ohio. That's where I came from, and I had never heard of the Creightons. I was born and raised in Perry County near New Lexington. That's where Alice, the oldest sister, was raised, and that's where she settled in. And so the Creightons were all over the place in Perry County, and I had never heard of them. And so immediately I felt a connection there. They came from where I came from. I came to Omaha, too, just like they did. So I found, and I've just found that the Creightons themselves are just fascinating people. It's a fascinating family. I'm so happy. I think you have a picture of John Creighton in your commerce exhibit. What a fitting character. I decided to choose John Creighton as a character instead of Ed Creighton because I wanted to talk about what Ed did a lot. And one thing the Creightons didn't do is talk about themselves very much. So I thought John could talk about his big brother and with pride and kind of get away with that and not have the feeling of being sort of self-pandering. Also, the whole idea of the telegraph. I teach computer science, and anyone who knows anything about networking in computer science knows that you have, in computers, you have routers, and you have lines. You also have some satellite and all that. But the way computer networks are set up is exactly the way that telegraphs were set up. Exactly. So I just found that there was a real connection there, too. I've lived in this age where computer networking grew up and exploded onto the scene. John Creighton grew up in an age where the telegraph did. So there are so many connections that I've just been fascinated about the Creightons. Yes. Yes, the telephone did come in between them. And the telephone was simply, I think, an adornment of the telegraph. You know, you, in fact, in some cases, used the same lines. Does anyone remember party lines? Yeah. My grandmother down in Appalachia had a party line, so when we went to pick up, sometimes no one would be on the right line, but we'd hear heavy breathing, and she'd say, "Oh, that's Myrtle. Don't worry about her. Just don't say anything that you would want, you know, just everyone to know, because Myrtle will tell everyone." So we still had the party lines, and telegraph was just like one big party line. Everyone could hear. Just like with computer networks, if you have a sniffer, which is a way of hooking onto the line and looking at all of the packets of information, you can see any message, whether it's intended for your computer or not. Same thing, you know. There were people who would sit at the telegraph station who were getting pretty good at deciphering messages just so that they could hear the news go back and forth. Why did they say stop after each line? I'm not 100% sure on that. And I wouldn't want to guess. I do remember when they said, you know, bank is burning, stop. Get water, stop. You know, something like that. I thought it was sort of a joke on cartoons more than anything else, because I think cartoons were the places that I did. So they got very, very fast. I don't know the exact numbers, but just the fact that the original telegraph was a pencil and paper system, and that's the original conception. Well, after a while, they got to just hearing it, and they knew what they were writing from hearing it. So after a while, it was just a sounder, which is where that word came from. I'm not sure. I know that they had banks and banks of operators and a lot of trained operators who became very proficient in what they did. In fact, I read an article about the women operators and when women became big telegraph operators. Perhaps it was during the First World War at that time, where there were more women available than men, but certainly there were women operators before that time as well. I'm sorry I don't have the actual speed, but I can imagine it being faster than anyone these days can do it, because they just had the practice over and over and over again. That was John. Yes, he became the count of the papal court and was made that way from Pope Leo XIII. And that's another thing I don't get into a lot, because you really have to know the day and age. At the time of the Cretans, the Irish had been the big immigrants and the big group that had immigrated into the country, and there was quite a bit of prejudice against the Irish at the time. And a lot of things, perhaps colleges, the Irish weren't allowed in to many of the colleges. That's part of the reason why the Cretans created a college that these Irish men and women could come into, and Irish Catholics. There was also an anti-Catholic sentiment as well as an anti-Jesuit sentiment for a while. In fact, I remember reading a letter where some folks had said, you know, that these Jesuits should not be allowed into Omaha. They're going to tear up and ruin our good little town. I'm not sure where that came from, but obviously there was, you know, some sentiment there. So he felt, and all the Cretans felt, like part of their duty was to be benefactors to churches, to altars at churches, and to create opportunities for their Irish American fellows and fellow people, both men and women. So I don't get into that a lot, because sometimes I think people don't necessarily understand what the climate was at the time. Certainly, I would not at all consider the Cretans to be sort of anti-Protestant or anything like that. They were just pro-Irish at the time. Well, I want to thank you all very, very much for listening and for having me here. I sure appreciate it.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series. We've heard a presentation entitled John A. Creighton, Blazing the First Internet, with Computer Support Coordinator for the Creighton College of Arts and Sciences at Omaha's Creighton University, Brian Kokensparger. This program, co-sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 15th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture in the series will be Saturday morning, May 31st at 10:30. At that time, Nathan Irwin, manager of the Smithsonian Institution's Otto Orkin Insect Zoo, located in the National Museum of Natural History, will give a presentation entitled Bugology. More information on this and other lectures in the series can be found at durhammuseum.org. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.